And before you do that, have you ever been to a predatory conference? Just tell us.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Looking forward to it.
But you're hoping, now, hoping one day.
Now.
One day. No, it was, so this was really...
Welcome once again to Free Associations from the Boston University School of Public Health. I'm Jessica Liebler, and I'm here with Drs. Matt Fox and Salma Abdullah from jointly the Departments of Epidemiology and Global Health here at the Boston University School of Public Health. We're going to discuss a commentary in Nature by Christine Rowe entitled, What is it like to attend a predatory conference? Very exciting. Matt, you want to jump in and describe what this paper was about?
Yeah, so this was, I love this. This is a really short article. It basically describes the journal sort of doing what I would consider almost investigative journalism, but it's not a very, wasn't meant to be a thorough investigation. It was more just, let's go to one of these predatory conferences. So for folks who don't know what a predatory conference is, we in the research world have to do certain things to merit advancing our career. One is we have to be good teachers. We have to, you know, do some service work. We have to, you know, bring in grants that cover our salary, some of us more than others. And we have to publish and present our work. And if you are someone who is struggling with the very last categories, publishing and presenting your work, there is this great solution that folks have come up with, which is these predatory journals and conferences where these companies effectively, you know, sort of come up with the idea for a conference, send you an email, say, we're so excited to have you, to invite you to come and speak on this topic. All you have to do is pay us $1,000 and you can come to our conference and be a keynote speaker. You know, if you're sort of new to this, to the field, or you don't get good mentoring, you know, these things, some of these are set up so that you can sort of easily tell they're predatory, and some of them look pretty legit, and they often have the names. The other speakers are some very renowned people, and you think, oh, well, if this person is part of this, then it's probably something good. So they went to one of these conferences, and my image of them was always that they were pretty legitimate conferences in the sense that it was an actual conference you go to, you give your talk, but that the audience is probably going to be pretty small because who's actually going to these things? You're not going to find anyone you really know in the field. And, you know, that's kind of the end of it. But what they actually found was, you know, some of them almost don't exist at all. Some of them exist, but they are basically like six or seven different conferences all smashed together. So you might have been invited, say, to the infectious disease conference, but you're the only infectious disease speaker. And then they got some people from other fields by advertising a conference in ophthalmology. And so the next speaker will be on ophthalmology. And you're not going to learn anything at this conference about infectious diseases because you gave the only talk. Sometimes they are sort of abruptly ended and they shift to online. They hire actual human beings to be there and run them, but those people also don't realize ahead of time that this is a predatory thing, and then they get no support, so they don't really know what's going on. It just was a really fascinating insight into something that I have been on the receiving end of, the fake, or they're real invitations, but these sort of fake conferences, but never knew what was on the other side. And I just found that fascinating to learn about.
I think this is one of the major functions of those spam catcher emails for the .edu email addresses in terms of the number of these solicitations for these meetings and also for submitting to predatory journals. But this being obviously a much bigger commitment of time. Salma, what was your verdict on this piece?
And before you do that, have you ever been to a predatory conference? Just tell us.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Looking forward to it.
But you're hoping one day.
Now.
One day. No, it was, so this was really interesting because I don't know why I always assumed you get scammed, but it never happens. Like, I actually did not think, my conclusion wasn't the same as yours. I thought people actually sign up and they think we're going and they pay, but then when you go, nothing happens. That was my assumption. Like, there's nothing at all.
That you show up
there's a few people there.
Conference. Exactly. Right. So it was interesting to me that there is a conference. I mean, it's not a conference, right, but there is something there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some people actually got refunded, which means to me, they're trying to keep like a viable-ish business model.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. And I, as you said, like it's really, maybe it's harder for some people to realize that this is predatory, but it's, at least to me, it seems very clear when you get the email. The other interesting part was there were a group of people who go there because they will just do it to improve their CV, even if they know it's predatory.
I can list this as I presented at some big international conference. Maybe nobody will even know that this is not a big conference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you then, though, I don't know, Jessica, what you thought about the article, but where do we draw the line on what's predatory?
That was my question, too.
So why are our conferences not predatory?
I don't know. There's a conference that we have, for example, that's a big conference in my field that all of a sudden the fees were super, super high.
The fees for many of these things are high. And there are often for-profit companies who are doing the organizing side of things.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're not for-profit, but they're charging very large fees. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's fair to ask.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. This is an interesting question, like kind of who's taking advantage of who in that kind of circumstance, right? Especially if, I mean, I think the big concern here, and I remember you were talking about mentorship, and I remember my dissertation advisor was very clear with us, because especially as a student, as you start to publish, it's really exciting. You get these solicitations to come to international meetings.
Yeah.
And she was saying, well, if they say like Dear Liebler, J.H., right? If they use your middle initial, if it seems to be like the Dear is bolded, if they forget your first name and just call, you know, or forget your last name and call you by your first name, you know, what are the signals that you're receiving a predatory or just, you know, and not above board solicitation. But I think for students, like I remember being a student and you kind of start to get, and it's kind of exciting.
Yes.
You don't have the money to attend a predatory conference as a student.
And with AI, I'm assuming it's also going to start looking way more professional.
I would think so, I think it's going to get worse, not better.
Right.
But so again, like, but should we stop going to our own conferences?
So the answer
I don't want to,
So my feeling on this is, you can the extremes are easy to spot.
Yeah.
So the conference that, you know, looks, when you get the invitation, looks totally disheveled, or you hear about it and like this, there's really not much of a conference. Okay, that's clear. The other thing I didn't mention is sometimes they would get there, find out that the big name speaker that was listed isn't there, and then they would write to them and they would say, I had no idea, you know, they just stuck my name on this.
Wow, yeah.
So there is some really bad practices going on. On the other side of it are the meetings that are sponsored by a professional society that, you know, we belong to. I'm not suggesting that there aren't still profit-making aspects of those. You know, I in the infectious disease field, there are definitely conferences that are super expensive, and you wonder what the purpose then becomes of that fee. But, you know, those I tend to put in the legitimate. It's sort of in the in-between. Like, if who decides when we go from, we cross the line? If we have a small meeting, we invite people, they do have to pay their own way, but, you know, there are some legitimate speakers there. Is that predatory? Probably not, but I don't know when do you get to the point at which it's, you know, no longer legit? I couldn't tell you.
I mean, and it's the same thing too with publications and journals, and we've talked about that here before, the kind of pay to publish model. This is actually just where you're taking a trip under a certain expectation. But it's hard to know, like, you know, to what extent is that different from a journal that just charges $5,000 to publish anything?
Yeah.
Basically.
Right? I mean, what we just discussed in a previous episode, Frontier, like for a long time, a lot of people did not publish in Frontier,
right?
So I would assume it's like it's in the middle category. But we're still discussing papers that are published there.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like even the ones that are sponsored by a society or association, similar to even publishing in Elsevier and Lancet, isn't it all predatory one way or another?
Well, so
are we the prey? Yeah. Is that what we're suggesting?
I think the problem becomes defining what is predatory about it.
Yeah.
So if And part of this comes down to like what we as a field consider important. I mean, we consider publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine much more important than publishing in, you know, the XYZ journal of whatever your field is. Does it necessarily make it better? You know, if they both have strong peer review, you know, is it, we would consider neither of them predatory, but one more important than the other.
Yeah.
So where do you cross the line into predatory? We tend to say with the journal, there's no peer review. There's, you know, it's really, we'll just publish anything. But, you know, I mean, we could go to a model where we just said we're just going to publish everything online.
Right.
No fees whatsoever, you know, other than maybe like a $50 processing fee for someone who has to maintain the website, whatever it is. You could move to a model like that, and then nothing is predatory. You can publish anything. So how much gatekeeping do we want? And at what point does gatekeeping move from being just a legitimate function to keep the quality of science, and when does it become a mechanism for money making?
Yep.
And can those two coexist? I mean, could we also have cases where it is legitimate quality assurance, but it's also a strong profit making center? As we know, like the many of the journals that are legit do, they are profit making machines for companies. So unclear to me where we draw that line.
Yeah.
Well, it's complicated now. I think you're right, because science is a business. And we are a part of that, even if we are moving with government resources, for example. Even if you have NIH resources supporting you, there still is a business element that, for those of us on the scientific side, the social scientific side, as we've talked about, you know, in public health or in medicine, I think we're a part of it, but maybe not the most aware players of all the forces behind the scenes, all the business forces behind the scenes that determine what gets published and where it gets published. And I feel like the biggest, you know, takeaway from this piece was more for students and for junior researchers, kind of just keeping a really critical eye to those invitations that
Absolutely.
You get and making sure that they're legitimate.
Yep.
Okay. Finally, we've made it to our final segment, Amazing and Amusing, which needs no introduction for our dedicated Free Association listeners. So let's just get into it. Salma, do you want to go first?
So I'm going to read you something, and I want you to guess which website am I reading from.
Oh, no. Okay.
So Governor Haley, NIBI to remain at wildlife facility as educational beaver.
Wait, say that once. Governor, this is Maura Healey.
Yes.
Governor Haley of Massachusetts. Colon.
Yes. NIBI to remain at wildlife facility as educational beaver.
Oh, you know what? So you mentioned this to me before as just the headline. I did actually vaguely remember hearing about this, but I don't know the story.
Yeah.
So the beaver.
So this is the government website, by the way. This is the Massachusetts
State government. Okay.
This is a press release.
This is a press release.
Yes.
By the government. Educational beaver.
So.
It's an educational beaver.
So NIBI was a poor beaver that was orphaned. And NIBI was then taken to a wildlife rehabilitation facility. So then NIBI apparently got very spoiled and would not play with other beavers that were introduced. I mean, they tried only once. When NIBI was introduced, apparently beavers like having other beavers to be able to function.
They're social animals.
Yes, they're social animals.
Do their beaver things.
So when
building
NIBI
the dams, it takes
was,
a group.
Arrived, there wasn't another beaver in the rescue place. And because of that, NIBI was never introduced to other beavers. And when other beavers were tried to be introduced to NIBI, NIBI just refused.
NIBI wouldn't join in any beaver games.
At all.
Got it.
Oh, no.
Then the government actually has guidelines on when wildlife need to be released to the wilderness, including beavers. So
okay.
They sent a request.
What the conditions are to warrant or required to be released?
No, required to be released.
Oh,
and this is where the drama started.
Oh
no.
Do tell.
They sent a request to the rescue saying you need to release NIBI to the
government,
wilderness.
The state government. Did.
Yes, they actually sent a request.
Because NIBI's confinement exceeded government regulations.
There was a
beaver.
No search warrant.
And there is no flexibility in the regulations. You have to leave now, and that's it.
Okay.
And then the rescue said, well, we don't think NIBI can survive in the wilderness and would like to keep NIBI.
Yep.
And the government said, no deal. Sorry, you have to release NIBI.
Mm.
Because we actually think it's important for beavers to go back to the wilderness. We don't want to keep them.
Wow.
I am having real trouble in the story figuring out if NIBI is the victim or the or the bad guy.
Yeah, so NIBI seems to be very happy. I don't know.
Yeah. NIBI seems happy in this rescue facility.
And she is very entitled, let's say, at least from the videos of NIBI.
Okay.
So ultimately then it was picked up by National news.
Okay.
And then there was an article, I think, in the Washington Post and then the Boston Globe. And people were asking the government and Governor Haley, where is she? Why is she not intervening on this really important issue?
Yes.
So then she did sign an executive order releasing NIBI from the responsibility of being released based on the regulations of the state.
So NIBI gets to remain in captivity.
Yes.
Despite meeting the conditions for release.
So the only conditions for release is time, not being able to.
Oh,
yeah. So
that's strange.
I think there are probably other, just like I don't remember it fully, but there are other conditions. But NIBI, so the rescue actually argues NIBI just doesn't have the skills that are should be required.
Yeah.
And the government says, no, based on our guidelines, it just checks all the boxes.
You got to go.
Yes. So now we have a press release on October 3rd from the governor that says NIBI has to stay and can't stay in the rescue place. And people are very happy.
Is she saying that NIBI now has a life of an educational beaver?
Yes.
Was that the educational beaver component?
Okay.
So I can't tell whether you think this is good or bad that NIBI is getting to stay.
I think like we live in a feelings. Very weird world.
Or is it just the ridiculousness of this?
Okay, but remember, every Thanksgiving, the president of the United States pardons turkeys.
You're not making a better argument. This is all fascinating to me. Again, as someone who has not grown up in the U.S., this is fascinating.
Was the context of the national media attention the ridiculousness, or was it? No, it was.
People were rallying.
Yeah. Save NIBI.
Yeah.
Got
save
it.
NIBI.
By not allowing NIBI to be released?
Yes.
Or which side was saving NIBI?
So it seems like the general public sentiment was let NIBI be NIBI in the rescue.
Okay.
NIBI is happy. NIBI. Why are you forcing NIBI to leave?
Yeah.
And this not enjoy.
Yeah. I feel like you don't understand the importance of this.
Okay. You can you explain it to me? That's the only question I actually had. I need someone to explain this to me.
I love it.
People get very attached to our cute animals.
I guess so.
In a rescue scenario, suppose,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I guess so.
But that was a good headline, though.
Yeah, it was a great headline.
I wonder, though, how NIBI is going to take on her new life as an educational beaver.
I don't know NIBI wants to be educational. I think NIBI just wants to enjoy life. I don't think she cares. Yeah. But if you're ever down, you should look up the new, I think it was a hippo that was born in Thailand. It's a very, very cute hippo that is taking over the internet. And that's another animal, apparently, that we care a lot about.
We do.
Right. So there's that as well.
Pandas, too. We love pandas.
And that's
koalas,
it for me.
Sloths.
Yeah.
With that, she's signing off.
All right.
Thank you. That was, I love that. The educational beaver. Matt, what about you?
Okay. Do you both believe in the placebo effect? Is it real?
I do think so.
There was a, this is in honor of Don, former host of this program who still loves the Ignoble Awards. Do you all know the Ignoble Awards?
I love those too.
Right? These are the awards that get handed out at Harvard for what I would say they consider to be kind of ridiculous research. But I actually think a lot of it actually is actually good research. It's just on stuff that comes across as weird. And one of the Ignoble Awards was handed out this year to a study that looked at the placebo effect. But they looked at it in a really interesting way, in my opinion, which is they had 77 participants who they told were going to receive a fentanyl, including nasal spray, so just a tiny amount of fentanyl, before they were then given a exposure to thermal pain. They're like heat, cold, thermal pain, right? You start to wonder, like, how does this go through an IRB? Except that they did not get fentanyl-included nasal spray. They just, right? Now, some of them, then what the nasal spray did have in it, in some of them, randomly, it was, I never know how you say this word, capsaicin, the stuff that's in hot peppers. And some of them didn't. The idea being that the nasal spray would induce a reaction that people would feel as being a side effect of the fentanyl-inducing spray that would make it seem more real to them. So again, nobody got the fentanyl. But they then exposed them to the mild burning, effectively, or they just got mild burning was the capsaicin. And what they found was that people who got the, hot pepper spray, effectively, reported less pain than the people who didn't. The idea being that if you are more convinced that you actually got something, your perception of its benefits in terms of reducing pain are larger, suggesting that side effects actually help improve the placebo effect.
Wow. That's deep. I still can't see it. This would never have gotten through IRB so here at BUMC with hats off to them. They'd never allow this.
So presumably these are all, because you have two things, right?
Fentanyl and burning people.
Well, no fentanyl.
I know, but even telling people they're getting fentanyl, lying to people, right?
That, you know, in the psychological sciences is slightly more accepted as long as the risks are, you know, the risks of giving some fentanyl are very low. Well, but they didn't give them fentanyl.
I know, but
what if the placebo effect itself was, if I feel like I'm getting fentanyl, then I start experiencing what people experience having received fentanyl.
That would be a really impressive placebo effect, I would say, if it induces that much of of an effect. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I could still see this being approved under the right conditions. And, of course, and then the exposure to the thermal pain presumably has to be pretty mild in order for an IRB. But they, you know, they approve studies, like challenge studies. Remember during COVID, they did, I believe in the end they didn't do them, but or maybe they did, I can't even remember. People volunteered to be in studies where they would get the vaccine or placebo, right? They didn't know which one they were getting. And then they would volunteer to be infected with COVID.
Yeah. Right.
The idea being that if you actually are infecting people with COVID, then you need far fewer people to actually identify the effects of the vaccine.
Right.
And lots of people signed up. Wow. So, and, you know, IRBs allow that in some cases under, you know, controlled conditions. So I don't know. But I was more fascinated with the idea that, like, the more convincing the placebo is that it's something real, the more the benefit of the placebo comes into play.
Were they suggesting, too, that hot peppers could be used as a painkiller or something along those lines?
I don't think that. No, I don't think they're saying that. I think they're saying the sensation that comes from the hot peppers, if you think it's related to the drug,
makes it seem
more likely that you got the drug.
I see. So they weren't saying the assumption that the hot pepper was actually dulling pain.
No, not at all. Okay, they were making the assumption that the hot pepper makes it seem more like you're getting a drug because the drug has a side effect.
Wow. So maybe adding a little bit of spice to some other medicines might help. Like even to a gummy vitamin.
So you're saying take the real medication
maybe
and give it a mild side effect that if it doesn't have one, because then your mind will add the placebo effect onto the real effect.
Or maybe, yes, or maybe this could be like, you know, gummy multivitamins, if they're spicy, maybe could have other benefits, right?
I think you have a great business idea here.
Spicy multivitamin
right,
gummies.
If you think it, like this has, this really has something.
Flamin' hot
multivitamin, gummy bears.
Flintstones.
Right. My kids love those gummy vitamins.
I mean, who does, right? They're so full of sugar.
They're just like, you popping them on the side.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. That is really cool. I have something a little bit different for myself. I have some jokes.
Okay.
Go for it.
I sourced through a number of different sources, including some Hopkins websites. I asked ChatGPT, and I kind of came up with a couple of them in conversations with my family. But what are some jokes about public health, medicine, epidemiology? Because I feel like we need a little levity.
Sure.
Okay, here's one. Why are epidemiologists so patient when they analyze their data? Because they know good things come to those who wait. Like
waiting the data, like a weighted index.
That is punny.
That's punny. Here's another one. This one, Matt, you're going to like this one more. Why did the epidemiologist break up with a virologist?
Why?
They just didn't have the right dynamic.
Dynamic modeling.
Okay. Why? Okay. Here's another romantic one.
Ooh. Is always great when Matt explains it.
Jokes are better when you have to explain them.
All right, here we go. Why did the climate scientist break up with their partner?
Why?
They said the relationship was too hot and cold.
It's a meteorology joke.
I know. What does a biostatistician call their father?
I don't know. What?
Data.
Data. Get it? Data, like data?
I like dad jokes, right?
Dad jokes. This is a dad joke. This
definitely
is
better when I explain
this. This is a dad joke. How many epidemiologists does it take to change a light bulb?
Four.
Just one, but they'll need a full cohort, a control group, and a meta-analysis to ensure the results are significant.
Okay, that one,
that one came from ChatGPT.
That one's pushing it. That one's pushing it a bit. Isn't there a joke that like somebody like, you know, like you're on an airplane and they say, is there a doctor on board? And if you're an epidemiologist, say, there's nothing I can do. I need a bigger sample size.
Yeah, that's a good one. Same idea. I have one more. Okay. I have one more. What's the difference between an optimist, a pessimist, and a public health professional?
Oh, boy.
The optimist sees the glass as half full. The pessimist sees it as half empty. You're getting where this is going. And the public health professional just wants everyone to use their own glass and not share.
Oh, I thought it was going to be something about filtered water. Oh, yeah, there you go. Okay, right. I like that.
Yeah, that was nice.
Not bad.
I don't know, but mildly amusing.
Some of them made me laugh.
Mildly amusing. Now, if those jokes contained a little bit of hot pepper,
then I might find
them funnier.
We need to dose ourselves beforehand and see if we laugh even more.
Yep.
Well, a little bit of levity. That is the end of our program. If you have any feedback on this or any other episode, or you want to suggest a study or topic for us to take on, you can reach us at Boston University School of Public Health's website. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope to see you again soon.
We hope Nibby has a long and entitled life.
We really do.
Long live Nibby.
Long live Nibby.